Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that seeks out challenging cinema so that you don't have to. We do so mostly these days by checking our respective streaming services, which is what drew us to our old standby, Netflix, through which we saw three new films. The first, The Boys in the Band, stars the cast of the 2018 stage revival of Mark Crowley's 1968 play, which was made into a 1970 film. Then we'll switch gears with The Devil All the Time, which requires us to head to rural Ohio, where we watch the likes of Tom Holland and Robert Pattinson act out a violent study of backwoods crime and punishment. And we'll finish with Enola Holmes, in which the English actress Millie Bobby Brown leads us through a missing persons investigation. Most appropriately, I might add, as she is the younger sister of her far better known, if no more clever, brothers Mycroft and Sherlock Holmes. Let's begin with a look at a party that is anything but festive. When Mark Crowley's play, The Boys in the Band, debuted in 1968, it truly was a groundbreaking bit of theater. Crowley's obituary in the New York Times, he died in March at the age of 84, makes the point that, quote, where previous plays and movies often tiptoed around a character's homosexuality or worse, demonized gay characters, Mr. Crowley's play presented gay men talking forthrightly and in depth about their lives, unquote. The same could be said of William Friedkin's 1970 film adaptation. These whole five decades later, much has changed, and yet much has remained the same. As directed by Joe Mantello, and updated both by him and producer-screenwriter Ned Martell, The Boys in the Band, which stars the 2018 Broadway cast, all of whom are openly gay, has been opened up to feel like an actual movie, even if its stage source is ever present. The acting, from the likes of sitcom star Jim Parsons to Star Trek favorite Zachary Quinto, is uniformly good. And while the production's effect is hardly what it was in 1968 or 1970, the message of people trying to survive in a world that has trouble accepting them for who they really are is as relevant today as it ever was.
I want to say, before I get into my feelings about The Boys in the Band, I've never seen this particular production on stage, but I have seen the 1970 William Friedkin film. So if I'm comparing the two different iterations, I'm comparing the two films, and I'm not comparing this to any particular stage production. Whenever we talk about plays that have been turned into films, there's always this notion of opening them up or making them more cinematic so they don't feel like they're stage bound. And I think part of the problem with this adaptation is that it's almost trying too hard to not be stage bound. The third act of this show, or I guess it would be the second act of the play, involves this kind of horrible parlor game that develops between all the characters. And I mean, I think that Crowley owed a lot to Edward Albee and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I mean, this feels like almost a riff on that premise. And in this particular iteration, the director keeps cutting away to flashbacks. And then later on in the film, we sort of get this epilogue at the end that is, as you said, very cinematic, where we see the characters outside of this apartment. So it doesn't feel like a one set kind of movie. And I get the logic there. I understand what they're trying to do. But I actually think by doing that, it completely lessens the impact of the drama. There's something about being trapped in this apartment, something that you can obviously capture very, very well in a theatrical setting where you've only got one set and the characters aren't going to leave it, that kind of, it just dampens the claustrophobia of it. And you look back at Friedkin's original film, which does not leave that one set except for a prologue at the beginning, the claustrophobia and the intensity and just the flop sweat that is going on in that apartment as these characters sort of confront one another and attack one another and knock each other down is so palpable and so intense. And here, even though the performances are really good in this 2020 version of Boys in the Band, I never felt the same intensity. And I don't know if it's because this is essentially a cover version of a much more well-known song. And so the impact is just diminished a little bit. I never really got into the intensity of this, even though I admired the technical craft of it, the performances, and I think the material itself still holds up. I mean, the play itself has had an unusual trajectory over the years because it was seen as groundbreaking when it premiered in the late 60s. And then in the 80s and 90s, when, you know, the new queer cinema movement was happening and these much more upbeat and radical and explicit queer narratives were coming out, this was seen as something of a relic for a long time. And now it's kind of come back in fashion as this important piece of historical documentation. So something that was once a radical idea is now a period piece, essentially. So I don't know. I liked parts of this. I think it's well done. I wish I could have seen it on the stage. I'm sure it worked a lot better. But yeah, there's some filmmaking choices here that kept taking me out of the movie, and I never got into the sort of, you know, sweaty intensity of the original this time around.
And so, Nathan, you're attributing that in large part, if not exclusively, to the way the film was made, with removing it from the single set piece and so forth. So do you think it has anything to do with the fact that we are looking at this, you know, so many years later? I mean, we're looking at this 50 plus years later. So does that have anything to do with the way that you or other audiences might perceive the differences between the 1970 film and this film?
I also think there's the added element of the original one, which, of course, when I'm watching that now, I'm looking at it as a period piece, too. It's just that that's a genuine period piece. There's the added element that a lot of the cast of the original Boys in the Band, you watch that film now and they're, most of them aren't recognizable. And it's because many of the original cast members were gay, but unlike the actors in this 2020 version, it affected their career. It essentially torpedoed their career. And then a lot of them died during the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s. So there's that extra kind of, you know, level of sadness that this one doesn't have.
Yeah, exactly. I like this better than the original. And I don't know whether that says more about the film or it does about me and my gestation over the last 50 years. I think that one thing that that is really clear is that times are so different now than they were in 1968. And as I was watching this new gestation of the Boys in the Band, I kept thinking, you know, this had much more to say in 1968. It was much more shocking. It was much more powerful. It was just such an original piece of work in 1968. But still, all those issues are still there. They just have transcended simply the notion of a bunch of gay men in an apartment jumping on each other. We now have the problems or the struggles faced by transgender, by, you know, the whole world of gender politics.
And then we have the pronouncements of two Supreme Court justices that seem to be pitting the individual rights of LGBTQ people against the religious liberty of others. So I think that it does feel a little retro. I wanted to talk just for a minute about the performances, because the cast, I think, for the most part, if not exclusively, participated or acted in this, the revival on Broadway. And so obviously they're very familiar with doing this in the two different settings. Of course, Jim Parsons was great, I thought. But Zachary Quinto, I mean, I was initially, when he came on the scene, I was put off by the curls. But his performance really grew on me because, you know, we've heard so much about the character leading up to his entrance. And then when we meet him, we're not really sure what to expect. And I thought that Quinto played that perfectly in terms of reinforcing what we've heard and then defying it at the same time.
And when it Parsons, we have to point out, you know, I think I pointed out in my introduction, is the star of The Big Bang Theory. So it is really nice to see him stepping away from that with some of the same mannerisms, because that's just who he is, but at the same time, amping it up a bit and showing he's more than just a simple sitcom actor.
Yeah, and I want to say about the comment I made earlier about, you know, the power of this story in 2020 versus the power of the story in the 1970 film version. I mean, I don't think that the power of the themes, or even just this idea of people not being allowed to be themselves or live their lives, has diminished in any way whatsoever. I just think that the filmmaking techniques that Friedkin brought to this material were much better suited for the material, because I actually just happened to see the 1970 version earlier this year, not knowing there was a film adaptation, a new film adaptation coming out. And I was really entranced by it and really sucked into it. So I think the power of that original film still exists. If you see this one on Netflix and want to go back and look at it, I think you'll still find it to be a pretty powerful experience.
Well, maybe so. I don't remember feeling the same about Friedkin's experience, but then I haven't seen it since 1970 either. So at any rate, that was our look at The Boys in the Band, the Netflix film. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at The Devil All the Time and Enola Holmes. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
What times we live in. A world pandemic, wildfires, working and education from home, and life hurdles for all of us. And yet, Spokane Public Radio, KPBX, KSFC, and KPBZ are still here for you to help make sense of it all with breaking news, facts, and background information, or music and entertainment when you need it. We are here for you because our listeners are here for us, and SPR can't do that without your help. Listener support makes up more than half of our operational funding. So please go to SpokanePublicRadio.org and give today. Take this opportunity to help your community stay informed with fact-based news and information, and enlightened with some culture and entertainment. For over 40 years, Spokane Public Radio has been on the air because of listener support from people like you. Thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101. I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the updated stage play adaptation, The Boys in the Band. Let's now move to some Southern Ohio slumming with The Devil All the Time and a bit of Me Too messaging with Enola Holmes. Let's begin with some rural violence. Just so you know, there really is a town called Knock'em Stiff, Ohio. It's an unincorporated area that sits about halfway between Columbus and the Kentucky border. So that much about writer-director Antonio Campos's film The Devil All the Time, which he adapted from Donald Ray Pollock's 2011 novel, is authentic. And perhaps the characters and the world they inhabit are too. But Campos, whose previous films include the intriguing 2016 biopic Christine, doesn't so much capture reality in his film as he caricatures it. Tom Holland plays a young man, the unfortunate son of a World War II veteran and his wife, who is intent on avenging his wronged sister. That brings him in conflict with the two-faced preacher, played with grand guignol fervor by Robert Pattinson. And oh, there's a couple that roams the countryside looking for young boys to, well, I wouldn't want to give away too many spoilers. It's enough to say that I stopped counting at a dozen deaths. The Devil All the Time has pretensions of capturing a time and place, and it does nearly redeem itself through director Campos's storytelling skills, including the use of novelist Pollock as a narrator. But it just made me wish I'd read Pollock's book instead.
I seem to be in the critical minority in this one in really liking this movie. I mean, maybe like is the wrong word, because this is, as you alluded to, a really tough sit. I mean, this movie is almost comically bleak. It's one of those films in which any time a character who seems to have any redeeming quality whatsoever shows up on the screen, you know that they're either going to be converted in some way or perverted in some way or just dead within a couple of minutes. It's one of those movies. And it's filled with very obvious biblical imagery and allusions to Bible stories. And so I sort of looked at this movie as almost like a string of really grim Bible stories, but there's also a lot of William Faulkner in this, especially in the way that it portrays, you know, kind of life in the rural South or Midwest, and a lot of the bitter irony of people like Flannery O'Connor. I think that she would have really enjoyed this movie. And I mean, this is a movie that begins with a literal crucifixion, and the image of that sort of haunts our first main character because it kind of jumps around based on the era we're in as to who our protagonist is, but it haunts this guy and it just kind of ripples throughout the following generations. I mean, this is a film about original sin and it is about the irony of fate. And I find it really interesting that Antonio Campos directed this because his previous films like After School and Christine with Rebecca Hall, which I know we liked a lot, are very kind of singular in their focus. They're about one person and sort of their interior lives. And this movie has a much wider canvas. It's about lots of different people over the course of two decades. It begins with World War II and ends as the Vietnam War is ramping up. So it's very epic in scope. And I understand a lot of the criticisms that this movie is getting, not just because of its kind of oppressive tone, but also just the fact that it's dealing with a lot, it's spinning a lot of plates and introducing probably more characters than it needs. But I just sort of really responded to the sweep of this movie, to the style of it, and especially to the performances. I know Robert Pattinson is kind of getting flack on the internet for his work here, but I think he's terrific. I love the weird choices he makes in this character. I think it fits the character. And Tom Holland is a really good kind of solid emotional support here. So yeah, I mean, maybe take my praise for The Devil All the Time with a grain of salt because it seems like I'm kind of on an island here, but
a bucket of salt, maybe.
A bucket of salt, so, yes.
So you talk about praise. I would say that I have appreciation for The Devil All the Time. I thought the art direction was spectacular because it is capturing these different periods of time, and to be able to do that successfully and make it feel authentic but still look artful at the same time, I think is very notable. I think my primary problem with the film, so we have the two performances by Robert Pattinson and Riley Keough, and they're so over the top in some respects that they seem incongruous in placement with the other characterizations. And as a result of that, and I'm not saying they're untrue or they're impossible. I mean, certainly anybody who's watched the Perry Mason series on TV, the most recent incarnation, can attest to the fact that these sort of charismatic preachers were way over the top in many respects. And I'm not going to make any comparisons to what's going on today. However, I don't know, there was just something about that that made it feel imbalanced. And that's why I think their performances have been getting some pushback, because they're almost comical in the way they're presented. And that sort of pulled me out of the film and then allowed me to become sort of more entrenched in the film. I do want to say one thing about The Devil All the Time. I did like Tom Holland's performance, but don't tell your teenage girls who might have been interested in his Spider-Man character that this movie is going to offer anything such as that for them to appreciate. You know, it's not your Tom Holland movie.
Yeah.
I just want to say that this is a film about hysteria, religious and otherwise. And so I think it makes sense that it occasionally tips over into, you could argue, outright camp. So I'm going to defend it on those grounds.
I think it does go into outright camp. And the problem for me is it just didn't feel, I don't know, there was a sense of authenticity. I kept comparing it to Jeremy Saulnier's film Blue Ruin, which we all liked very much. And I thought, it's the same kind of movie in many ways without the religious backdrop. And so that worked for me. Blue Ruin, look for that one. Devil All the Time, not so much. But
I like both.
Let's close with Enola Holmes. It's becoming more and more common to see variations on traditional themes and stories, giving those characters who have either been marginalized or worse, ignored, the opportunity to tell their own tales. Taking advantage of that moment, young adult novelist Nancy Springer created a series of mystery stories featuring the teenage Enola Holmes, younger sister by 20 years of her famous detective brother, Sherlock. In this movie version of Springer's character, the engaging English actress Millie Bobby Brown plays Enola as a 16-year-old who awakens one morning to discover that her suffragette mother, played by Helena Bonham Carter, has disappeared. Spurning the efforts of her new protector, the elder Holmes brother, the arrogant, supercilious Mycroft, played by Sam Claven, who wants to civilize her, Enola runs away both to seek out mom and along the way come to the aid of a young lord. And even without having to depend upon the skills of her famous detective sibling, played by Henry Cavill, she proves more than up to the task.
I was skeptical about this movie because I thought it sounded too much like some sort of fan fiction notion of Sherlock Holmes, who has always sort of held a revered place in my heart. But I have to say that Millie Bobby Brown won me over almost from the very beginning, because she's just such an enthusiastic, spirited, you know, knockoff from her, as you said, her feminist mother, with all of these different skills and talents and so forth. And it's a cute film. It's a family film. It's something that I think a multi-generational group of people could appreciate. Henry Cavill, Superman, you know, is too tightly clothed throughout this. But apart from that, I really enjoyed this movie, unexpectedly so. And I would recommend it as a family watch.
Yeah, Henry Cavill as Sherlock Holmes. I mean, I recall all of those references to Sherlock Holmes' barrel chest and beautiful face constantly.
Right. It's such Jeremy a weird Myers casting choice. As Sherlock Holmes would have been more appropriate casting.
Sure. But yes. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's safe to say none of us are in the target demo for this particular film. I thought it was perfectly fine. I think that its target demo will probably like it a whole lot and will want more of these. And I know there's a long series of books. I'm sure they have a lot of material to work with. And even though, you know, when you throw around a word like cute, it can come across as demeaning, but I do think it applies here. At the same time, I mean, I think it is dealing with serious issues of, you know, women's rights and their position in society, especially in Victorian era in society. So it's one of those period pieces that has like very 21st century ideals, which sometimes rubs me the wrong way because it feels like affectation. But I think they do a good job of working it throughout the story and the central mystery so that it doesn't just feel like window dressing, like, hey, we're checking all the right boxes to seem woke or whatever.
And I just want to point out that Millie Bobby Brown, if she looks familiar, that's because she was from Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. You know, I totally was shocked by that because I didn't recognize her. I mean, she's grown up, you know. I mean, it's been a few years.
And she's Ferris Bueller-ing all through this movie, you know, waking at the camera and talking directly to
exactly.
us.
Exactly. Right, breaks the fourth wall all the way through.
Yeah, which I got a little tiresome for me, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. And that was Enola Holmes. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And early in the show, Nathan Weinman and Marie Petruthart and I discussed the adaptation of the revived stage play, The Boys in the Band, and the study in Righteous Revenge, The Devil All the Time. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarbert for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial. And we'll again check out all the best that streaming cinema has to offer. Until then, remember these words from the late author and social reformer Helen Keller. The highest result of education is tolerance. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.